Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who takes a critical look at President Obama's order for U.S. military action against ISIS forces in Iraq, which she believes could make a bad situation worse. Tom Stevens, an activist with the group Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management, who discusses Detroit Citizens' campaign to impose a moratorium on the mass shutoff of residents' access to water and restore service. And Rebecca Wilkins of Citizens for Tax Justice, who talks about the need for passage of legislation to prevent corporate tax inversions where American companies reincorporate as a foreign-based enterprise to avoid paying U.S. taxes. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Hundreds of human rights activists protested outside of the U.S. State Department during the opening of President Obama's Africa Leaders Summit, which brought together 50 African heads of state to Washington, D.C. to boost trade and investment. Activists were angry that leaders from Ethiopia and the Democratic Republic of Congo were given red carpet treatment at the three-day summit, despite a record of serious human rights violations. According to Human Rights Watch, Ethiopia has used its anti-terror laws to lock up opposition activists and forced journalists and civil society dissidents into exile. Activists were also upset with the presence of Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, who faces charges from the International Criminal Court. The goal of the U.S.-Africa summit was to boost U.S. trade and investment in the subcontinent, as well as advocate renewal of the African Growth and Opportunity Act in Congress. During the summit, $33 billion in investment deals were announced, including commitments made for President Obama's Power Africa initiative to build a state-of-the-art electric power grid. The Obama summit follows years of trade gains by China in Africa. In 2012, China surpassed the U.S. in its import of commodities from the continent and now ships home twice as many goods from Africa as does the U.S. U.S. District Judge Myron Thompson overturned Alabama's 2013 law requiring the state's abortion doctors to have local hospital admitting privileges as unconstitutional. Judge Thompson ruled that the anti-abortion law, signed by Alabama Governor Robert Bentley, put an undue burden on the state's five remaining abortion clinics. In the 172-page ruling, the federal district judge declared the state's interest in promoting health care in the law was exceedingly weak. If the law had been upheld, three of Alabama's women's health clinics would have been closed. The legislation was challenged by Planned Parenthood and the American Civil Liberties Union. In his ruling, Judge Thompson wrote that if the law had been enforced, a significant number of women would have been prevented from obtaining an abortion. Others would have been delayed in obtaining an abortion, exposing them to greater risks of complications. Further, the ruling noted women who are denied the right to an abortion would likely try to obtain illegal medications to induce one. In his decision, Judge Thompson noted the hostile climate that abortion providers face in Alabama. An abortion doctor was shot and killed in 1993, and a bomb exploded outside a women's clinic in Birmingham in 1998. In neighboring Mississippi, a federal appeals panel reached a similar decision, overturning that state's admitting privileges law, as it would have resulted in the closure of the state's only remaining abortion clinic. Public water supplies were shut off for 2 days in Greater Toledo, Ohio, forcing over 500,000 people to drink bottled water. The culprit was a large-scale green-blue algae bloom that contaminated the city's drinking water supply, exposing the public to microcystin, which can cause vomiting, numbness, and dizziness. Despite an end of the current crisis in Toledo and Lake Erie, the season for algae blooms will not peak until September. According to Mother Jones magazine, algae blooms are caused by a concentration of phosphorus pollution triggered by a runoff of agricultural fertilizer and municipal sewage systems. In early June, the Federal National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, released its annual forecast for algae blooms in western Lake Erie. The report predicted an algae bloom half the size of one that occurred in 2011, when 40,000 tons of toxic algae overtook the lake. The NOAA forecast noted, after a lapse of 20 years, blooms have been steadily increasing over the past decade. Efforts to regulate fertilizer runoff and agricultural pollution have run into opposition from the powerful Fertilizer Institute, the principal industry lobby group. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
With President Obama's August 7th authorization for U.S. military action targeting forces of the radical Sunni group, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, that has taken over large areas of northern Iraq and Syria, American soldiers are once again engaged in a war inside Iraq. The Pentagon has launched airstrikes against ISIS forces threatening the Kurdish regional capital city of Erbil, as well as airlifting relief supplies to tens of thousands of minority Yazidi refugees who have fled to Mount Sinjar in the face of ISIS militant attacks. Although the president has said the U.S. involvement in Iraq this time will not involve boots on the ground, there are growing concerns that the return of U.S. forces to Iraq, the third war involving American soldiers in Iraq since 1991, could quickly escalate into a major commitment. This was evident in a recent report that the White House was considering deploying more U.S. troops to Iraq, in addition to the 300 American military advisors authorized in June. Facing growing U.S. pressure, Iraq's parliament replaced Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki with Haider al-Abadi, a member of Maliki's own Shia party, but it was unclear if the former U.S. ally would relinquish power without a fight. Your reporter spoke with Phyllis Bennis, director of the Institute for Policy Studies' New Internationalism Project. Here she takes a critical look at President Obama's authorization for renewed U.S. military action in Iraq and alternative policies she's proposed to address the crisis brought on by the ISIS takeover of Sunni population centers in northern Iraq.
You have this huge problem in Iraq where the response of the Obama administration in terms of what he says is absolutely right. There is no U.S. military solution to this crisis. Absolutely right. So then the question emerges, so then why are you sending military actions if they're not going to work, you know? And that's where it gets dangerous, because what we're seeing, the idea, first of all, that you can, with weapons of the sort that the U.S. has in its military arsenal, with bombs and with rockets, that you can somehow defeat Islamic extremism. We know that doesn't work. It hasn't worked anywhere. They've been trying for more than a decade now, and it hasn't worked anywhere. So that's the first thing. But the other thing that we have to recognize, that as bad as ISIS is, and it is indeed a very grim outfit, it's not, you know, it's not something we should take lightly. These really are people who want to return their standard of governance to the 7th century, essentially. But as bad as that is, the reason that they are so powerful is not that this relatively small group of very extremist militia, somewhere between 8,000 and 10,000 people total, despite their very good weapons, the reason they're winning territory, the reason they're able to hold territory, is not because they're somehow magically stronger than every other militia in town. It's because they have local support, their power. So who's supporting them? Well, first you have their own military leaders, from what we understand, are actually not Islamic extremists. They are Ba'athist, secular, nationalist generals and strategists and military officials, military officers, most of them from the period of Saddam Hussein's army, which we should note was a very capable army. These are the people that are creating the strategy, the training for the ISIS forces. That's number one. Number two is the Sunni tribal leaders who have their own militias that they are putting at the disposal of ISIS, not because they also agree with this kind of extremism. These guys, like the Sunni generals, they drink, they smoke, they're people of the modern world, but they are prepared to ally with anyone to go against Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's sectarian Shia government. And third, you have support coming tragically from ordinary Sunni Iraqis. Tragic because these are people who are forced to ally with an organization that they can't stand in most cases, who are also not extremists, not trying to go back to the 7th century, but who are unable that in any other way they can imagine to fight against this terrible government that has been so repressive, that has arrested Sunni Iraqis for no reason, that has tortured people, that has killed people without any kind of due process. And they're, again, willing to ally with anyone to oppose Maliki. As long as the U.S. takes the position that we can simply bomb the truckloads of militia guys, this isn't going to change. The only thing that will change it is a real change in the government in Baghdad, meaning not just the election of a new prime minister. They elected a new prime minister, Haider Abadi, but he's a member of Maliki's own party. So the question, is this going to be any different than it was under Maliki? We have no idea. There's simply no evidence yet that things are going to change as dramatically as they need to change.
Senator Lindsey Graham said a couple of weeks ago that ISIS, if they are unchallenged and they are to remain in control of the territory, both in northern Syria and Iraq, if they're allowed to remain there, that will be the next staging ground for the next attack on the United States. And I wondered if you would just respond to the idea that there's an existential threat here that the United States must meet with military force.
Yeah, the notion that this is somehow an existential threat is simply nonsense. Is there the possibility that somebody affiliated with ISIS who happens to have a U.S. or a European passport could come and carry out some kind of a terror attack? Yeah, theoretically that's possible. People could come from anywhere and carry out a terror attack. Somebody could come from Paris. Somebody could come from London. People can come from anywhere, and that's a danger that's real. The notion that that is somehow an existential threat to the United States is simply nonsense.
Phyllis, in your recent article, Don't Go Back to Iraq, you wrote about five policy options that you say are more constructive than a military response to the ISIS forces occupying northern Syria and Iraq. Could you summarize those for us?
Well, I think the first one starts with do no harm. There's a sense that anything the U.S. does militarily is likely to make things worse than things have been before. So we can start with the notion of don't make things worse. The second thing, there should be an immediate arms embargo on all sides. And that means going back exactly to these regional allies, the Saudis, the UAE, Qatar, and telling them that they have got to prevent these weapons from going to all the various militias on all sides, essentially. Third, there should be immediate engagement with Iran. You know, this is the irony here. In Syria, it's even more overt, but even in Iraq, Iran and the U.S. are on the same side. Both want to go after ISIS. Both are trying to give some legitimacy to the government in Baghdad, although both, for somewhat different reasons, have had problems with Maliki. The notion of being willing to engage with Iran towards some kind of pressure campaign to push the Iraqi government to stop the kind of sectarianism that has characterized it, to stop the violence against civilians, this is one thing that could really work. Then there should be engagement much more broadly through the United Nations in terms of engaging with Russia and the others to create a new kind of international negotiating table. There's got to be a political solution here, and there's going to have to be all sides engaged. This is the same thing we've been talking about in Syria. Washington has got to stand back and allow and encourage the United Nations to play the central role rather than insisting on running it itself. And then last, the U.S. should help to get assistance to the people who need it. There are enormous new refugee crises and a humanitarian crisis going on right now. We owe Iraq an enormous debt, but we don't owe continued bombing and continued threats of occupation.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Find more analysis and commentary on President Obama's authorization of U.S. military action in Iraq by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Over the past few months, a water crisis has erupted in the bankrupt city of Detroit. It's not a crisis of water contamination, as has happened in Toledo, Ohio, and other American cities this year, but one of water shutoffs for thousands of customers unable to pay their water bills. The shutoffs have been called a human rights violation by the United Nations. While some families have been able to get their water turned back on, for thousands of others, the crisis continues. Some critics charge that the water shutoff is part of the bankrupt city's restructuring plan and is leading toward privatizing Detroit's water and sewerage department. Detroit activists are now campaigning for a moratorium on all future water shutoffs, restoration of service to all those households that no longer have water, and full implementation of a water affordability plan that was first proposed in 2005. That plan calls for a rate discount based on income, water conservation measures, consumer protections, and collection initiatives directed toward customers having the ability to pay. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Tom Stevens, a lifelong Detroit area resident, an attorney, and one of the coordinators of the Communications Working Group with Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management, which collaborates with another grassroots activist group, the People's Water Board. Here, Stevens talks about the impact of the water shutoffs on Detroit families and how residents are organizing to resist privatization of the city's water utility.
Here we are in the heart of the greatest concentration of fresh water on the planet. You know, we're not in drought-stricken California. We're not in Mesopotamia. We're not stuck in a desert somewhere. If there's any place where you can provide water on an equitable basis as needed so that people aren't, whatever their other issues are, suffering from lack of the necessities of life in terms of water, it's here. So then reality intrudes, right? That's the environmental context and the geographical context. And then you have, you know, what we call emergency management here in Michigan and in Detroit. And yes, the New York Times and others have correctly focused on this as a national and perhaps even global precedent-setting way to deal with the ills of 21st century industrial society. So what's happened here is that as part of the restructuring and the bankruptcy and the imposed austerity measures that are being put on the people of Detroit by Michigan's Governor Rick Snyder through his unprecedented emergency management policy, the powers that be in their wisdom in the spring, because they want to regionalize and privatize the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department, which is a regional water and sewerage service for 4 million people and throughout southeastern Michigan, because they wanted to work this kind of a deal, they figured, you know, it would be good to cut off these poor scofflaws and deadbeats and all these other names they call them in order to dehumanize them. So they paid a contractor to start going out and cutting off families at a rate of about $3,000 a week, and that was what precipitated the crisis.
I read a statement from a human rights official who said cutting off people's water because they can't afford to pay, as opposed to because customers are unwilling to pay, is a human rights violation. Is that what people are organizing around who are opposed to the shutoffs?
Yes. The United Nations General Assembly in 2010, I believe it was, adopted an international convention on water and sanitation as a human right. And that's what people are referring to, is that to the extent that the shutting off people from access to water is based on their inability to afford the costs, that draconian policy is a violation of international human rights. There was a complaint that was filed by the People's Water Board, the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization, the Blue Planet Project, and Food and Water Watch with the UN in early June. And within about 3 weeks, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights had a letter that was affirming that three human rights experts said, yes, if that's what's happening, that's a violation of human rights.
Did that play a role in getting the water turned on for some households, or did those people just pay their bills?
It's been a mixture of things. Mostly it's because they paid. First of all, the crisis is by no means over. The city is just scrambling around to try to cover itself. But there have been some instances where, recognizing how badly this was all going, where people could demonstrate hardship, for example, disability, emergency medical needs, where they have turned on water in a few instances, I understand it. The vast majority have been where people have found the money somewhere to pay some of it. The department has changed its policy, so as of last week, they're now demanding only 10% of the outstanding bill to turn it back on. None of this, of course, solves the underlying problem, and it's not just a problem in Detroit. It's a problem in every community where there is aging infrastructure for water, which is every community, and especially where there's low income, is how do you pay for this essential service and infrastructure for our lives? And the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization back in 2005, with the help of an expert named Roger Colton, had proposed a water affordability plan that, you know, would be fee structure and rate structure based on ability to pay, that would charge those that can pay more and charge those that can pay less what they can afford to pay, so that people aren't paying these astronomical percentages of their income. You know, some of the reports that we've seen recently have got people paying over 25% of their income for water. I mean, that's just not sustainable.
Tom Stevens, according to one article I read, one of the reasons behind shutting off people's water was just to try to get them to leave.
As part of the restructuring, there is a thing called the Detroit Future City Plan, which is basically, you know, what they used to call Negro removal, to satirize the phrase urban renewal, on a huge scale. And yes, the idea of, well, you know, hey, we can shut people's water off, you know, if they haven't paid their bill, it's put on their taxes and you can take away their homes. Yes, this is a huge way to leverage the removal of people that, you know, they find to be undesirable and get them out of the way. Detroit is 139 square miles of very cheap real estate in a water-blessed place on the planet. It is one of the most busiest international border crossings in North America. It's a tremendous economic prize. You could just get some of these people out of here, you know, and take over the resources and take over control of the place. And that's what they're doing, and that's what this is part of.
In many parts of the country, people's water bills are still quite low, much lower, say, than their cable bills.
Nationally, what the industry says is that water is by far the most underpriced retail utility that you have. You know, people pay less for water than they pay for almost anything else, and that's a big problem because the infrastructure really, you know, much of it was built in the 19th century, and it really needs maintenance. And, you know, the other thing about that that's so painful, especially when you look at Detroit's bankruptcy, is if we were putting resources into that, we'd have enough work to keep people at work for generations. But that's not our priority.
That was Tom Stevens, an activist with the group Detroiters Resisting Emergency Management, which collaborates with the People's Water Board. For more perspectives on Detroit's massive water shutoffs, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The issue of corporate tax inversions has come into focus in recent months, with the pharmacy retail chain Walgreens' reluctant decision not to immediately relocate its headquarters to Switzerland in order to avoid paying U.S. taxes. Pharmaceutical giant Pfizer had attempted a tax inversion when it sought to acquire the British-based drug company AstraZeneca. Although the deal fell through in May, Pfizer is reported to be considering launching another takeover bid this fall. Last March, Chiquita Brands International, the nation's leading importer of bananas, announced it would merge with the Irish fruit company Fife's and relocate its corporate headquarters to Ireland. An increasing number of U.S.-based companies have been preparing to embark on tax inversions by acquiring overseas corporations and then relocating their corporate offices to foreign cities for the purpose of tax avoidance. In response, the U.S. Treasury Department has warned that immediate and strict action will be taken against companies planning tax inversions. It's estimated that the U.S. Treasury loses between $30 and $90 billion a year in tax revenue due to companies setting up offshore tax shelters and engaging in tax avoidance schemes like inversion. In a late July radio address, President Obama charged that companies engaging in tax inversions are technically renouncing their U.S. citizenship and called for short-term steps to block what he labeled as an unpatriotic tax loophole. Congressional legislation being proposed by U.S. Senator Carl Levin and his brother Representative Sandra Levin, both Democrats from Michigan, would effectively deter future corporate tax inversions. Your reporter spoke with Rebecca Wilkins, Senior Counsel for Federal Tax Policy with the group Citizens for Tax Justice. Here she discusses her group's support for fixing tax code loopholes and passing new legislation to discourage corporate tax inversions.
What's happening is that companies are doing a merger with a foreign company, and in most cases, the American company is much larger, and they're acquiring a foreign target. And then they're reincorporating in a third country, or maybe the home country of the foreign corporation. And then they're claiming to be a company in the UK or in Switzerland or in the Netherlands instead of an American company. And this gets them out of paying some U.S. tax. And the thing is, they're not actually moving. So, for example, Medtronic, a medical device manufacturer that's headquartered in Minneapolis, announced that it was going to acquire Covidien and reincorporate in the UK. And they said, but we're not moving. We're going to stay in Minneapolis. So they intend to stay in the States and take advantage of all the things that government pays for, but they aren't going to help us pay for them.
Approximately, how many companies have opted to do this tax inversion thing, and how much money does it cost taxpayers who have to make up the difference?
Well, the tax revenue lost is sort of a hard number to nail down because companies are already shifting a lot of U.S. profits offshore and claiming that they're earned in foreign jurisdictions. For example, in a recent year that the IRS looked at, U.S. companies claimed that they earned 16 times the amount of Bermuda's gross domestic product in Bermuda, which isn't possible, right? So companies are already trying to shift profits offshore. But what an inversion helps them do is it makes it easier for them to shift the profits offshore. The Joint Tax Committee scored a bill that's currently in Congress on stopping inversions at raising $20 billion over the budget window of 10 years. But we actually think the revenue estimate is much, much higher than that.
So as I understand it, neither the White House or the Treasury Department can do much to plug up these tax loopholes and prevent future tax inversions by these big corporations. But Congress has the key here. Maybe you could summarize for us what exactly is being proposed in Congress to close off this tax inversion loophole.
So the bill that's been proposed is co-sponsored by Senator Levin and Representative Levin, brothers who are both from Michigan. And the bill would require that there be at least a 50% change in ownership in order to move your tax domicile out of the U.S. So foreign shareholders would have to own a majority of the company in order to give up your U.S. citizenship, so to speak. I mean, that's only one possible solution. There are lots of different ways they could do it. One of the things that happens for U.S. individuals is if you renounce your U.S. citizenship, you basically pay an exit tax. So you pay some income tax on the assets that you have accumulated at the time of your giving up your citizenship. They could do the same thing for corporations. They could say, if you do an inversion, we're going to tax all of that offshore cash you have hoarded away on the date of inversion. So there's lots of different ways they could tackle the problem. The question is, does Congress have the political will? I mean, they have to stand up against Wall Street and against these big multinational corporations. And they won't do it unless the public pushes them to do it.
That was Rebecca Wilkins, Senior Counsel for Federal Tax Policy with the group Citizens for Tax Justice. For more discussion and articles about corporate tax avoidance, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.